our next patient, sorry, our next speaker, and I can't thank you enough, Jennifer, for hanging around and being later on the list, and we're behind on a Saturday. But Jennifer I've known for several years, and she's a nurse practitioner in hematology at the Jurovinsky Cancer Center in Hamilton. Her focus of work is in hematological malignancies, autologous and allogenic stem cell, and bone marrow transplant. She also, at one time, was chief of nursing practice for the Jurovinsky Cancer Center in Hamilton and nurse practitioner for the breast disease site, so she comes with a lot of different experience. She has a Bachelor of Science of Nursing from McMaster and a Master of Nursing degree and an acute care nurse practitioner credential from U of T. She holds a clinical cross appointment in the School of Nursing at McMaster and an associate member of the Department of Oncology. She also is past president of the Canadian Association of Nurses in Oncology and is a current member in the executive of the Canadian Blood and Bone Marrow Transplant. So please welcome Jennifer, for we're very, very lucky to have her speak.
Thank you. That's so nice of you. Hi, everybody. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Sue and Lymphoma Foundation Canada for inviting me to talk to you today. This is my first visit to the Lymphoma Conference, and I've learned a lot today. We've got a really distinguished group of speakers, so I thank you very much for inviting me. My name is Jennifer. I'm a nurse practitioner from Hamilton, as you heard, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit today. You can see on your agenda about managing side effects and stress and supportive care and the diagnosis of lymphoma. That is a pretty tough thing to do when I know that all the people who have preceded me today have been asked to speak about different types of lymphoma and their treatments, and you can't do those talks without talking about side effects. So I'm going to try very hard not to be repetitive, but to try to just pull all those threads together and perhaps give you a few strategies for your own life. And then once I have my slides, we'll be off to the races. That's all? Nope, that's not me. There's me. Okay, living well with lymphoma. So the objectives for the next 25 minutes are to give a high-level review of the most common side effects of lymphoma and its treatments, because in 25 minutes we could talk about any of the topics that you've seen today on the agenda for a whole day. So we're not going to be sending you out with as much meat as you may be hoping for, but hopefully some strategies to find what you need out there, both with your teams in your cancer centers and perhaps on the web. I want to talk about three of the most common side effects. They may or may not have affected you or your family member. And I want to validate and discuss some of the emotional changes and challenges that can accompany a diagnosis of lymphoma and its treatment. And also, I want to provide a little insight for you into the supportive care team that may be hanging around either a little bit behind the scenes for you or perhaps right in your circle of care, and the role of screening for symptoms. One of the things that always strikes me, I think, when I meet a patient newly diagnosed with lymphoma, and keep in mind I work on an inpatient unit, so the patients that I meet are admitted to the hospital usually because of symptoms that can't be managed at home, so they're quite sick. And they've learned that they have lymphoma, a serious disease, and they've learned that they're going to be facing a number of months of therapies, and their minds are full of new information. So only a short while ago, a productive person living their life in the routine, in the zone, in control of all the things usually going on around them, feeling completely capable, and then being dropped into this kind of new void with all this new information and a whole new language to learn. And sometimes as I listen to what we tell patients, and I think about all the new words and all of the new ideas that are trying to squeeze into the brain, not only about lymphoma, but also about the types of treatment for lymphoma. We heard a little bit about the alphabet soup of chemotherapy, and I haven't added on there CVP or CEP or CEPPR or all the other things, or even the word modified that often accompanies chemotherapy. PICs and ports and Hickmans and apheresis catheters and ways to get blood taken that are easier or not. These are things that may or may not have been brought up to you as a patient or your family member with lymphoma. Some people may require a central venous access device like these, and some absolutely might not. So there's no right or wrong, but all these new issues are coming in. And then as we just heard from Dr. Buckstein, in addition to learning about the lymphoma, and in addition to learning some of the new language terms and trying to understand what they all mean, there may also be an additional decision to be made about whether or not to participate in a clinical trial. So it's incredibly overwhelming. We know from the literature that's published that patients retain probably less than 10% of the information that they get in their first visit with their oncologist or with their hematology team. And in my mind, there's absolutely no wonder that that's true. And I know that's why patients do look to the net or try to keep their questions written down on a piece of paper when they come back. Sometimes you might feel like, I already asked that question the last time I came. I really feel kind of silly asking it again. Ask it again. We all know how hard it is to remember all the information you've been given, and the only way for us to make sure that you have what you need to make good decisions and to live well with your cancer is to know that we're meeting your information needs, so please keep that in mind. And finally, the counts. The counts. The counts are up, the counts are down. The counts are good, the counts aren't good. What are the counts? And we're going to talk a little bit about the counts. So we've heard a little bit about the common side effects related specifically to lymphoma, the disease, and we heard about B symptoms, classically fever and some weight loss and some night sweats that happen prior to the diagnosis of lymphoma. If you feel comfortable, put up your hand if you've ever felt B symptoms. I know lots and lots and lots of people present with B symptoms. They're not unusual at all. Fatigue. We heard about fatigue. From chemotherapy causes fatigue. Lymphoma causes fatigue. Radiation causes fatigue. Anxiety causes fatigue. Fatigue is a huge issue. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later. Lymphoma can also cause pain and swelling just because of the enlarged lymph nodes or masses in the body that are causing pressure and pushing on other things. There are side effects also to chemotherapy, and of course you've already heard about them today, so I'm not going to belabor these. But risk of infection is probably the number one risk of chemotherapy and probably is reviewed with patients and families in the most detail, I think, at that first meeting, because that probably is the most dangerous thing that can happen. Fatigue again, nausea, vomiting, loss of appetite, change in taste, bowel changes, sleep disturbances, and hair loss. I'm going to just pick a few of those things a little bit later and talk about them in a bit more detail. And we just heard about radiation therapy and side effects related to radiation. Fatigue is something that has been documented with radiation. It's not very well understood how that might happen, but we know and we heard that really no matter where you're getting radiation, fatigue can be a side effect. It may be because the body's in a constant state of inflammation and those inflammatory cytokines are just moving around your body and just wearing you out. Kind of like how being pregnant wears you out. Even when you're sleeping, you're getting tired. And that may be one of the things that's going on with radiation. We're not sure. Skin reaction used to be a bigger side effect, I think, with radiation before we had more advanced technologies. It's still something that we see, but it's very mild in comparison to the past. And as we heard, the side effects largely depend on where we aim the healing rays. If the healing rays are being aimed at your belly, you're going to get side effects in your belly. If they're being aimed at the chest, then the side effects may be different. So that's something that will be gone over, I think, when you make decisions about whether or not to have radiation. I wanted to take a minute to talk about the counts. White blood cells, neutrophils, we, your healthcare team, who are very well-meaning, often use those two words quite interchangeably, right? So what is a neutrophil? What is a leukocyte? What is a neutrophil? What is a leukocyte? It's important to remember that leukocytes are the white blood cells, all of the white blood cells, one big bucket. Those white blood cells work to fight lots of different kinds of infection, bacterial infection, viruses, what other kinds of infections can you think about? Any others? Your immune system making antibodies, all those different kinds of infections are fought by the white blood cells. The most important white blood cell that we think about in hematology or in oncology is that neutrophil. The neutrophil is the white blood cell that's designed specifically to fight bacterial infection. And when those levels are low, when your ability to fight a bacterial infection goes down, that's when it can become dangerous for the patient. Neutrophils make up 60 to 70% of your entire bucket of white blood cells. So all your blood cells that make antibodies, all your blood cells that fight viral infections, the neutrophil is probably the number one player and makes up the most of the white blood cells. And they can go down quite low as a result of treatment for lymphoma. So we watch those counts very carefully. When those counts go down and you're at risk for infection, you may develop a fever. And I know that your teams have told you this, but we consider a fever when the white blood cell counts are low as to be quite an emergent situation. So you've probably been told to call right away. I always tell my patients, please don't wait till morning And please don't wait till Monday if you have a fever. It's very important that you call and let the team know. There'll be somebody there that can ask you a few questions on the phone. They may or may not tell you to come straight to the hospital. They may or may not tell you that they're going to phone a prescription for an antibiotic into your pharmacy, depending on how you answer some of the questions on the phone. Oh, sorry. So it's important if you develop a fever. Number one, have a good thermometer at home, a thermometer you can rely on. Any fever over 38 twice in one day, or over 38 and a half even only one time, deserves a phone call to your team. When you call, they're going to ask you about signs or symptoms of infection. Think about shortness of breath, cough, coughing up phlegm, an ingrown toenail on your big toe that's red and swollen or tender, or may not be red and swollen, but only tender. Does it burn when you pee? Have your bowel movements changed? Think about all those things as you're making that phone call. What am I feeling? What might be the cause for the fever? Most of the time, there's absolutely nothing. No symptom, no real anything you can put your finger on. Blood cultures will probably be taken to see if we can identify the bacteria, but most of the time, we never identify it. If the counts are low and a fever is there, that's febrile neutropenia, and it requires antibiotic therapy, even if we can't identify for sure the cause. And the antibiotics will probably be kept going right up until the counts recover and the fever's been gone for a while. If you need IV antibiotics, this may have happened to some of you in the room having to be admitted to the hospital for IV antibiotics. Those IV antibiotics will continue until the counts recover, and then you'll probably change over to oral antibiotics and then be stepped down after that. So that's a little bit about fever and neutropenia. It is dangerous. It is something that you need to report, and it's not something that you want to wait to identify. And the second is fatigue. So very many contributors to fatigue, and these can include anemia. So when the counts are low, the hemoglobin may be low. And if the hemoglobin is low, you just don't have enough trucks to move the oxygen around your body to give your muscles and your body the energy it needs to get through the day. So low hemoglobin can cause fatigue, for sure. That may be one cause. Pain, chronic pain, can be a contributor to fatigue. So treating pain may actually be one way to help treat fatigue. Lack of sleep or sleep disturbance. Anybody in the room ever had a problem with this? Steroids, maybe? Adds to this. Sleep disturbance is a big issue for patients with cancer, but very much so in the hematological realm because we use a lot of steroids, prednisone, dexamethasone, that can interrupt sleep, not to mention anxiety and nervousness and depression and other things that can have an impact. So fatigue is something I think that's really important to think about. Medication side effects, some of the pain medications can cause fatigue, impaired nutritional intake can cause fatigue, depression and disease itself can cause fatigue. So I just tell you one very quick story. When I worked as a primary nurse in breast cancer, I went to pick up my messages at about noon, and there was a message from a patient I knew very well, and it said, "Patient's very fatigued, please call." So I called, and the phone rang and rang, and finally she answered, and she said, "Hello?" And I said, hi, it's Jen, I'm calling back. I got your message that you called because you're really tired. Can you tell me something a little bit more about that? Can you describe it for me?" And there was this big long pause, and she said, "I'm just so tired that I can't talk to you." She hung up the phone, boom, right in my ear. And I thought, okay, that's probably the number one evidence for me that this is fatigue not like something I've ever felt. Patients say, "I go to bed, I get up after 10 hours, I don't feel rested, feel tired all the time. I have no gumption. I don't really want to go grocery shopping. I don't really want to go to meet the teacher barbecue. I don't really want to go, to the family birthday party. I've just got no initiative. This fatigue is so overwhelming." So it's important to have some strategies, I think, for dealing with fatigue. The good news is it's temporary. I ran into that lady 2 years later at a large patient conference, much like the one we're having today. And she zoomed by me as she came in, and she had a beautiful haircut. She had gorgeous earrings on, I remember, and a big shawl sort of wrapped around her. And she was flying through with some friends, and she stopped, and she looked back at me, and she started to laugh, and she said, "Yeah, I was really tired that day." And she remembered hanging up on me. So the good news is, you know, that it's temporary, but it's something that you will remember because it's not a fatigue that other people can understand. The other frustrating thing for some of my patients is, you know, well-meaning and loving family members will say, "Well, we've just got it. Let's just go. Let's just get out. I'm just going to give you some really special food or some really special something, and your energy is going to get up, and you're you're going to be a little bit more like your normal self, and we're going to be able to do some normal things, and you'll feel better. And sometimes that's just not possible. I tell my patients to think about fatigue like we think about our bank account. You have an account that has a finite amount of energy in it. And when you're undergoing cancer and its treatment, that bank account of energy is going to be a little bit smaller. And also your opportunity to make deposits into the account is going to be a little bit more curtailed. So how might you deposit some energy into the bank? Number one, we've heard today about some of the benefits of exercise. So if you can exercise, as long as it's not something that's contraindicated by your team, thinking about how you might be able to get 30 minutes of exercise, and I'm talking specifically about when you're on treatment, into your day will help you make some deposits into the energy bank. Eating well. You might need a dietitian to help you here. When we talk about eating well, I'm talking specifically about taking in protein, because in order to heal, your body really needs it. And if we don't give it to our body through eating, your body's going to steal it. And it's not going to steal it from where I would want, like my bum. It's going to steal it from your bones and your muscles and your lean body mass, areas that you can't really afford to have taken from you. So it's very important to think about how, if I don't have a great appetite, and if I'm having trouble eating, how am I going to make sure that every bite counts? How am I going to make sure that I'm meeting my protein needs through the day? And you may need a dietitian to help you with that, and your cancer center can always hook you up and provide you with an opportunity to meet with a dietitian to talk about some of the best choices to make around food. How else can you make a deposit? I think stress reduction is really important. Very easy for me to stand up here and say it, but everyone who's been diagnosed with lymphoma or any other serious disease, as well as a long, lengthy treatment that may or may not take them away from work or their earning potential, may or may not be changing their relationships at home. Stress reduction is exquisitely unique and personal for every person. And so we would ask, your team would ask, that you be really open and honest with us to help us understand what are the biggest stressors that are going on with you and how can we hook you up. If we're not the right people to help you with that, how can we hook you up with people who might be able to help you with coping strategies for stress? And energy conservation. When someone offers to drop you off at the door and then go park the car, say sure. Say sure. Don't say, oh, no, I'm good, I'm fine. Take those opportunities to save your energy so that you can spend them wisely. When it comes to withdrawing from the bank, think really carefully about how you want to spend your energy. Don't spend it scrubbing the tub or the toilet, please. Spend your energy doing the things that you really love to do and find other opportunities to get those other things done. When people say, what can I do to help? Then really tell them so that you're not spending energy doing things that you don't value, things that don't give you joy. Spend your energy doing those things and it'll get you through treatment a little bit easier. Does it make sense? Good. And ESAS screening. I'm going to talk about ESAS screening at the end. That is the screening tool that many of you have interfaced with at your cancer centers. Finally, nausea and vomiting. We've heard a little bit about this already today. Your team is going to work with you to try to identify the cause of the nausea, because there are many different causes. Most oftentimes, nausea is caused by drugs. That could be chemotherapy. It could also be pain medications. It could be antidepressant medications. It could be any number of medications causing nausea. What else can cause nausea other than drugs? Just call out. Anything? Any ideas?
Smells of food.
Excellent. We're going to talk a little bit about food. Constipation? Really constipated? No room for anything to go down? Constipation can cause nausea. A lot of people think that lymphoma or cancer treatment in general is just all about the diarrhea. It's diarrhea all the time. It's not always. We do give you medications that cause constipation, like pain medications, anti-nausea medications, and the more constipation you have, the less you may be wanting to eat. So that's one thing to think about. Am I going regularly? If not, so your team's going to ask you about that. Obstruction of the bowel. So obstruction of the bowel by tumor or other causes can also cause nausea. Anxiety, depression can also cause nausea. So because there's so many different potential causes, it's important not to just make assumptions that it was just the chemotherapy. So your team will be asking a few questions to try to come up with the reason for the nausea, and then hopefully a multi-pronged approach that may help you. And so that may include medications, for sure, but also we heard a bit today about food. Limit the spicy, the fatty, the salty, and the sweet, and limit the smells by keeping your food from being too hot. We've heard this already today. Eating small amounts is great more often through the day, the high-protein things, but also eating off a smaller plate. Don't take the big dinner plate if you're not that hungry. Take the lunch plate, put some stuff on, eat that, say good for me, put it aside, and a few hours later think about what else am I going to fill up the plate with. But try not to overwhelm yourself. Sipping fluids, staying hydrated, and trying to limit caffeine and alcohol will help. The emotional challenges that come with lymphoma treatment and diagnosis are enormous, way beyond what we can talk about in 25 minutes. And when I made this slide, I just put that black line there. I didn't really ask myself why I put that black line there, but when I look at this, it kind of has come to me that I was thinking about what goes on the inside and what's pushing in from the outside that may all be emotional challenges for people facing serious illness. Living with uncertainty, I think, is one of the most challenging things that faces any patient with cancer. Because the thing you really want to ask is, what's going to happen? And the one thing your team will never really be able to tell you with certainty is exactly what's going to happen. So trying to come up with a toolbox, some kind of way of living with uncertainty and being at least relatively okay with it is one of the big challenges of living with lymphoma. The more years go by, the more time you've had to sort of live with that new reality and understand how it's really affecting you begins to dim this as a big emotional challenge after a while. And sometimes patients who've been diagnosed, you know, years and years before become the absolute best support for people who are going through this in the moment. And that's one of the places where support groups can be helpful for some people. Depression and anxiety and guilt obviously can also come along with this. And sometimes the guilt is just about not being able to be the same person you were before and not being able to meet all of the responsibilities that you've always met quite easily, and it can be tough. So having to explore some of your past strategies for coping can be helpful. When did I ever face something hard in the past? Maybe not this hard. And what were the best ways that I had to manage that? And some of the external things that can happen, change in roles, maybe not being able to work anymore, maybe not being able to volunteer with the same gusto as before because of fatigue or side effects, changes in relationships, changes in the way we are able to be a spouse or a sister or a brother or a mother or a father or a contributor to our congregation or at work. These can be really difficult. Some patients have come back to me, though, and said, you know, in a lot of ways, if there's anything positive about what I've been through, it's been because my relationships are better. I've discovered that some of the people that I thought would really be there for me actually weren't, and some of the people that I really never dreamed would be there for me have been there for me in spades. It's been a great opportunity for me to find out and learn a little bit about the relationships in my life and really, really appreciate them, and some people have said that that can be a positive. Everybody has advice. Is this right? Everybody has advice. Sometimes you want it. Sometimes it's welcome. Sometimes not so much. Sometimes just be positive. If you have a positive attitude, everything's going to be fine. And I remember my mom turning to me one time and saying, if one more person tells me to be positive, honestly, I'm going to lose my mind because I'm trying my best. But it makes me feel like if I can't be positive today, I'm my own worst enemy and I'm doing my best. So it's really important to know when people give you advice, it's always coming from a good place, for the most part, a good, loving place, people wanting to say things that are helpful. But sometimes they hit you and you think, oh my gosh, I just can't take it. As well as information about complementary and alternative therapies, which we heard about today. I read about this great thing. It's going to be it for you. I got it off the internet. Here you go. Here it is. There are some very good tools and very good resources for you around those complementary medicines, and we'll talk a little bit about those. There is a website called CAMEO, Complementary and Alternative Medicines Outcome Project. CAMEO is a research program within the University of British Columbia. So if you search CAMEO, C-A-M-E-O, and University of British Columbia, you will come up with a link to the CAMEO page. And on the left side, there's a lovely, lovely little link that just says useful links. And CAMEO will only put up links for alternative and complementary medicines that have been evaluated in a more rigorous way and then give you some information about what we found about them, whether or not there's some indication that they work and where they may not be safe to use. So that's at least one resource that's kind of helpful. With respect to supportive care, we know that patients with cancer need it. We certainly know hematology lymphoma patients need supportive care. All the supportive care literature points to it. So in every cancer center, no matter where you're being treated, you have a whole lot of resources to try to attend to supportive care needs. First and foremost is your hematology team. Please, please, please don't be afraid to be open with them and let them know where you're having a struggle. If the hematology team finds that the interventions that they're trying really aren't meeting your needs, there's a pain and symptom management team, usually led by a physician, often a physician and a nurse, sometimes a physician and a nurse and a social worker, and their focus is just that, pain and symptoms. And if it's beyond what your hematology team's been able to help you manage, because of the escalation of the effects, that team can see you in consultation and help. In addition to that, though, there's a whole host of other people that are available to you in most of the cancer centers. At least a proportion of these people are there. Psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, nurse practitioners, social workers, dietitians, chaplains, physios, occupational therapy. You're very lucky if your center has a physio and an occupational therapist, by the way. But knowing that they exist is really important, and I want to tell you that because they're there, you really should be using them if you can. Are you okay? And just one last plug for the ESAS, the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale. Hands up if you've interfaced with this, either on paper or electronically at your cancer center. Hands up if anyone has said to themselves, seriously, I have to do this again? Honestly, I just did this. Oh, someone's laughing up here. Like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that was me. Frustrating a little bit, I think, for patients when they interface with ESAS all the time. But let me explain to you a little bit why that's a big, big priority for us. Not only in Ontario, but the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer has made this symptom and distress screening a priority for the entire country. It's very important. When you come to your visits, I'm hoping that you're being asked about these few things, and in addition to what we see on the list, there should be an other. So the number one is pain, and basically this scale asks you to rate these from no symptoms to the worst possible symptoms on the bottom on a 1 to 10 scale. Pain, tiredness, meaning decreased energy, nausea, depression, feeling sad or feeling blue, anxiety, nervous, jittery, restless, drowsy, sleepy, can't keep my eyes open, appetite change, well-being, overall, how are you feeling, shortness of breath, and other, all on the scale. If this scale works properly, if you score anything 4 or higher, this is only a screening tool. So if you score 4 or higher, this should twig your team, usually your oncology nurse, but your oncologist or whoever is looking after you that day may do this, a more in-depth assessment of that particular symptom. And depending on the assessment of that particular symptom, we'll take them to an intervention algorithm to help understand, well, what can we do to help and make that better? In some cancer centers, the screening actually comes to the care team like a graph so that for each of those 10 symptoms, they can actually see when was it a 1, when was it a 5, when did it go back to 2, and where is it today, and what do I need to do about it? So if you're one of those people that's going, seriously, please fill it out. Okay. If you're saying that because I fill it out and nobody ever asks me about it, I fill it out and nobody ever looks at it, I challenge you to challenge them. Especially if there's a symptom on the screening tool that is 4 or above, please make sure that you have a conversation with your team. So in 25 minutes, or hopefully a little bit less, I've taken you through a whole lot of information, not in a lot of depth. I hope it met some of your needs, and if you have any questions, I'm not sure, Sue, whether we're taking questions
we're
or are we going to...
questions in the panel and after the
questions
lesson.
At the end. Okay,
if
thanks,
you,
everybody.
If you can hang around.
I'm not going to be able to
Okay, then.
I'm not going to be able to hang around
right
for the
now,
panel, so
questions.
Maybe if we had just a couple, I could answer them. Anybody?
That paperwork that you said there, is that for like all oncologists should be right now or different that or
the scale?
Yeah.
Is anyone not seeing that scale? Anybody not seeing that? So different cancer centers have rolled out ESAS, or the symptom assessment scale, in different ways. So through different disease site teams, sometimes hematology is at the front of that train, sometimes hematology is at the end. If you've not seen that and you're seeing people in an Ontario cancer center and you've not seen the screening, ask why. Find out when it's going to be coming to a clinic near you, because I do hope that if we as a whole province continue to do this, this also provides data to Cancer Care Ontario, largely electronically, so that we can understand about all the patients across the province and how they're doing. So please ask if you're not seeing it. Anything else? Thanks for your attention, everyone. Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to say I wish beginning or during chemo. I just finished it. Because such basic things about what neutrophils actually are, or just a couple of other things about the fever thing, it wasn't explained in a way that I could really understand. It's the first time I really understood.
Oh, thank
it.
You.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody. That means a lot to me. Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks so much. Thank you so much.